Those of you who know me know that I am the denomination guy. I am big in knowing what denominations are up to. I'm big in knowing what they believe and why they believe it. I am big in understanding the inner workings of various denominations because growing up, I didn't have answers to those questions. I would often pass churches that were Baptist churches, Methodist churches, and I would see other denominations doing events, and I would say, "Well, why don't we go to that event? Why don't we do this? Why don't we do that?" And the answer was generally the same. Well, we're not Baptist. We're not Methodist. We're not this. We're not that. It's like, okay, well, why aren't we that? Why aren't we this? And it was just, there was no general reason why, as other than that's just not what we do, that's just not we what we believe. And so that really sparked in me an interest for understanding why denominations do the things that they do, why they do the things they do, why they believe what they believe, why they function the way they do. So that's kind of a brief history over why I know so much about various denominations, and that's kind of the psyche behind how I grew up Pentecostal and have ventured out into other various denominations, sects, and movements, and things like that. I was a part of a Southern Baptist church plant for a while. I was a member of a United Methodist Church for about 5 minutes. I just kind of I've been everywhere, man. Which is, which is kind of the song that I sing when I think about the various churches that I've been in. But for those of you who know me, you know that for the last 7 years I've been camped out in the Cumberland Presbyterian Church. As far as the confession of faith goes, as far as what the Cumberland Presbyterian Church believes on paper, I'm all for it. The doctrine and the theology is solid. But holding people accountable to the confession of faith has not gone so well. The Cumberland Presbyterian Church is fighting within itself over the whole alphabet soup issue. It's fighting within itself over the LGBT inclusion issue. Should we have LGBTQ pastors? Should we have LGBTQ elders? Should we force that issue? It's a struggle that United Methodists have been having, are having. It's a struggle that the PCUSA has gone through, is going through. We're not different than any other mainline denomination in that regard. However, I have been keeping up with what's going on within the world of Methodism for some time. Because as a Cumberland Presbyterian, I learned early on that whether or not Cumberland Presbyterians realize it, they are mimicking the United Methodist Church. They are mimicking the United Methodist Church in the trends, in how they legislate things and how they do things, even though the polity is different. The trends are pretty much the same. And so, what I have determined is that wherever the United Methodist Church is, you can bet that the Cumberland Presbyterian Church is not too far behind by about 5 to 10 years. So, I've been keeping up with Methodism. I've been keeping up with what's going on in the United Methodist Church for the last, well, 5 or 6 years. So, as I've been keeping up with the General Conference of the United Methodist Church and them looking at the issue of regionalization, it has really, well, it's really weighed heavy on me. I've been watching Jeffrey Rickers over at Plain Spoken cover the live stream of the General Conference, and I've been listening to what he has to say. I've been talking to Global Methodist pastors. Even though they're not United Methodist anymore, they're still keeping up with what's going on in the United Methodist Church. I've been talking to them about these issues. getting their thoughts and on where they stand on some of these things. And so what I want to do is I want to cover an article that Mark Tooley put out over on Juicy Ecumenism. I want to talk through that, and I want part of this to serve as a warning for the Cumberland Presbyterian Church, and really a warning for anyone who is serving or a member of a church in a liberal denomination. And I also kind of want to touch on the while we're on this, train of thought, I also want to talk about the Reconquista movement. If you don't know anything about the Reconquista movement, what I found is that unless people are on Twitter, they really don't know anything about Reconquista. But what I have seen is of the Reconquista movement, it's inspiring in a way, but I don't fully subscribe to the attitude behind it. Well, let me first explain what Reconquista is. Let me back up. So Reconquista started with this young man. His name's Richard Ackerman. His username is Redeemed Zoomer. He's a young man. He's technically a Zoomer, hence the username. He's got a YouTube channel and a Twitter account, and those are his two main outlets. Okay, that's not a good thing or bad thing. That's just an is. Okay, those are his two main outlets, and he is a conservative, a theological conservative, who is a member of a PCUSA church. And what he wants to do is he wants to basically get what conservatives are left in the PCUSA together. He wants to band them together and say, "Hey, let's take back the PCUSA. Let's return the PCUSA to a theologically conservative movement." So as a PCUSA, even though he is a PCUSA member, he's against women pastors. He's a full 5-point Calvinist. I'm sure he subscribes to the infallibility of Scripture. He is a theological conservative. He is what progressives would call a fundamentalist lunatic, which is a badge of honor for him. Well, of course, I've been called a fundamentalist lunatic too. So I'll take that as a badge of honor myself. But he is not what you would think of as a typical PCUSA dude. Okay. And so Reconquista is an effort to get theological conservatives within liberal denominations fired up about taking their denominations back. So that's pretty much the sum root of what Reconquista is. And I'm surprised that it has as much of a following as it does. I'm genuinely surprised that it has as much of a following as it does, because there's a dude, I think his name on Twitter is like Method Ministries or something like that. He's a Methodist. He's a conservative Methodist. He's in the United Methodist Church, I believe. And he's all about trying to take the United Methodist Church back. So there's dudes out there who do subscribe to the Reconquista. Now, here's my issue behind it. My issue behind it is that I don't know that everyone is called to that kind of work. So Redeemed Zoomer, I mean, I'll just refer to him as Redeemed Zoomer since that's his username. If you said Richard Ackerman, I don't think anyone who follows him would know who you're talking about. So Redeemed Zoomer has criticized folks like the CREC. He's criticized Doug Wilson. He's criticized the PCA. He's criticized pretty much anyone who has broken off from the PCUSA and started their own conservative movement, because he thinks they're cowardly. He thinks they should have stayed and fought for the PCUSA. And so he criticizes anybody that wants to get out of that liberal sphere and move forward with conservative theology, with with people who think a lot, right? He thinks if someone is a theological conservative, and he thinks everyone should be a theological conservative, which I do too, but he thinks that if you're a theological conservative in a liberal denomination, you should stay where you are, even if it means sitting under, a lesbian Buddhist pastor, I guess, and fighting for the recovery of the PCUSA. Now, so he thinks everyone ought to do that. My thing is, I'm not sure that everyone is called to do that. I'm not so certain that a lot of the conservative dudes have the will to fight a lot of things, right? And I say that as someone who is losing the will to fight myself. It's not that I want to give up and just let everything, you know, take its course. But as someone who is in the Cumberland Presbyterian Church that is watching it move in a liberal direction, it's wearing on me, man. It's really wearing on me. And that's part of the reason why I won't get into all of the reasons why I withdrew my name as a candidate for ministry in the Cumberland Presbyterian Church. But a lot of it's just plain wearing on me, man. Just going to presbytery meeting after presbytery meeting and watching people that I know and that one time had respect for and trust walk up to the microphone on presbytery floor and say that it's unloving for us to say that homosexuals shouldn't serve as pastors or elders, you know? It just wears on me. Because what happens is, whenever you make a true statement, right? Whenever you make a true scriptural statement, such as, we need to have biblically qualified pastors and elders, and then you lay out what the qualifications for those pastors and elders are, it's interesting to watch people's reactions. Because people will react one of two ways, okay? They will say, amen, you're right, those are the qualifications we need for people who will serve as pastors and elders. And then you will have a second group of people who will say, no, you know, that's closed-minded. That's too limiting. That's, you know, you're not being broad enough, you know, things like that. And when people start that, rhetoric, you know they're not working with a biblical worldview. And in a lot of cases, they're not even working with a Christian worldview. Okay? So, so to bring this back to the United Methodist Church. United Methodist Church has been doing their general conference this week. The United Methodist Church has been doing their general conference this week. And basically, what they're meeting about, the main thing, one of the big things, is regionalization. So here's why this is important. Back in 2019, when they had a general conference, what they said was they voted by majority, and 53% of them said that we shouldn't have homosexual pastors and elders. That's what they voted for. That's what they voted for in their book of discipline. So, and the reason it swung to 53% was because there was a lot of African delegates there, and the African United Methodist Church is very, very theologically conservative. They seem to have good heads on their shoulders. And they were able to swing the vote, okay? So a lot of the United Methodists that were left in the United States, they're theologically liberal. they were in favor of having LGBT pastors and elders. So, the delegates were able to swing the vote in a conservative way. And so the liberals had to come up with a game plan. Well, during all of this, the Global Methodist Church was born. The Global Methodist Church was a group was started by conservative United Methodist pastors and elders, who basically said, "Hey, we are tired of this liberal nonsense. We need to go back to Wesleyan roots. We need to go back to traditional Methodist values." And so we're not going to have homosexual clergy. We're going to go back and rediscover what it means to be truly Wesleyan, truly holiness. We're going to go back and discover what it means to be a traditional Methodist. And so they started the Global Methodist Church to do that. And there was a lot of disaffiliations that took place. A lot of conferences lost a lot of churches and pastors. And the Global Methodist Church was born out of a desire to go back to biblical holiness, to go back to Wesleyan tradition. So when with a lot of the conservatives, probably even most, with most of the conservatives gone from the United Methodist Church, that leaves a vacuum, and of course, nature abhors a vacuum. So the liberals come in and take those empty positions on councils, committees, seats, whatever, and they're coming up with a new game plan. They got to do something because a lot of the African delegates, a lot of the African United Methodists, they didn't go global. They're sticking with the United Methodist Church for now, but they're still theologically conservative, and there's enough of them that they could still swing the vote. Okay. So liberals have to come up with a new game plan. So they got together and said, "Well, let's do regionalization. Let's do this regionalization thing that would allow each geographic region to come up with its own rules for the Book of Discipline. So the African United Methodists can be theologically conservative if they want, and they can bar LGBTQ clergy if they want." And the United States and Canada can have LGBTQ clergy if they want, and they think that'll make everyone happy. Well, I didn't even include well, how to say it's the best part. It's not the best part. It's terrible, actually. But African delegates were swinging the vote back in 2019, to be theologically conservative. Well, what happened was, in response, a lot of liberal UMC clergy came forward and basically said that the reason Africans voted that way is because they're backwards, right? They're culturally backwards. Liberal UMC clergy basically said that the African United Methodist Church is theologically conservative because they're culturally behind us. And so if that's not racist, I don't know what is. You can't get, in my opinion, I don't think you can get much more racist than being a white liberal, who has the gall to say that the Africans are culturally behind us because they're more theologically conservative. So yeah, I just thought I would bring that up. But anyway, we fast forward to this regionalization thing, which the United Methodists were voting on at General Conference. And it passed. It passed. So each region's going to get its own book of discipline, it looks like. But now that I've brought you all up to speed on that, I wanted to show you this article from Mark Tooley that got posted on Juicy Ecumenism. This is the title, Methodism's Last Meaningful Conference. This was posted 2 days ago. I'm just going to read the article and comment on along the way. United Methodism's General Conference started yesterday, April 23rd, in Charlotte, North Carolina. By the way, if you want an analysis of the things going on in United Methodism leading up to the General Conference, I highly recommend you go check out the Plainspoken podcast, the Plainspoken YouTube channel, and watch the Considering Charlotte series that Jeffrey Rickman's been doing over there. United Methodism's General Conference started yesterday, April 23rd, in Charlotte, North Carolina. It will likely be the last important governing convention for United Methodism as the denomination, with the rest of American denominationalism recedes into almost irrelevance. This General Conference will liberalize United Methodism's teachings on marriage and sex, over which traditionalists and progressive have fought across 50 years. Yeah, I couldn't believe that. I mean, I knew this wasn't a recent thing terribly, but I didn't think it had gone back 50 years. I was shocked when I learned that. And I didn't learn that in the article. I learned that, oh, probably about a year ago, looking through Chris Ritter's stuff over on peopleneedjesus.net. He's been doing a good job documenting all the stuff going on within United Methodism over these battles. And so I found out this has been a conversation since the 70s, which is incredibly wild to me. Between 2019 and 2023, over 7,660 traditionalist churches, including up to 1.5 million members, exited the denomination under a temporary policy allowing departure with property. In 2019, a special general conference, which is the one I mentioned earlier, reaffirmed United Methodism's official policies affirming sex only within monogamous male-female marriage by a vote of 53%. After the traditionalist mass exit, this general conference should easily overturn the official teaching. Proposed new language would remove prohibitions and simply affirm human sexuality as a sacred gift and acknowledge that sexual intimacy contributes to fostering the emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being of individuals and to nurturing healthy sexual relationships that are grounded in love, care, and respect. It declines to connect sex to marriage or even to monogamy. Yeah. So when you separate sex from the intended if you separate sex from its intended use, from its intended purpose, then all you've got is complete sexual chaos. It's horrendous. Of the seven major mainline Protestant, historically liberal denominations, United Methodism, which is the largest, is almost the last to liberalize sexuality, or liberalize sexually, preceded by the United Church of Christ, Episcopal Church, PCUSA, Evangelical Lutheran Church, and the Christian Church Disciples of Christ. The American Baptist churches, originally the Northern Baptist Convention, have not officially liberalized. That'll be interesting to see if they do. United Methodism is nearly the last to liberalize, thanks to its large membership in Africa, which is overwhelmingly traditionalist. By the way, I think it was only like 30% of the African delegates that were supposed to come to General Conference actually made it, because there were issues with their visas. Yeah, that's awfully convenient. That's all I'm going to say about that. That's real convenient. Previously, United Methodism had reported 7 million church members in Africa and 5.7 million in the U.S., but inexplicably recently reported 4.6 million in Africa. After church exits, U.S. membership is likely about 4 million. In 1968, United Methodism, in its year of birth, after a merger between the Methodist Church and the Evangelical Brethren Church, had 11 million members in the U.S. There are some who would argue that merger was a mistake. I don't really know enough about it to comment either way, but I've heard people say that was a mistake, and that's what actually led to liberalism within the United Methodist Church. Like I said, I don't know. I don't know enough about that particular merger to comment on that, but that's what I've heard. In the 1960s, United Methodism and the Southern Baptist Convention had all about the same membership. Southern Baptists are also losing members, but its membership is now about three times United Methodism's, 4 million versus 13 million. Many have wondered why traditionalists exited United Methodism when they had, across 5 decades, won all the major sexuality votes from 1972 through 2019. It's because they could see the writing on the wall. Okay? It's because they could see the writing on the wall. That's why. So, this is very similar to where I'm at in the Cumberland Presbyterian Church. So, in the Cumberland Presbyterian Church, we've been having this conversation across the denomination about whether or not we should have LGBTQ clergy or elders, right? So if you go by our confession of faith, if you go by our constitution, like you can clearly see that there's no room in our confession of faith or our constitution for LGBTQ clergy or elders. Like it's plain and black and white, okay? And Alan Meinzer, who is a Cumberland Presbyterian pastor, and he is probably the closest thing our denomination has to an apologist. He has been clear about this. He has done his homework, and which really there's not much homework to do if you just look at the Confession of Faith. Read the scripture citations that are associated with each statement, and then look at the Constitution. So there's not really that much homework to do, but Alan Meinzer went above and beyond what's required. He did a deep dive into this issue, and he showed that on no uncertain terms, that if you go by the Confession of Faith and you go by the Constitution in the Cumberland Presbyterian Church, there's no way. There's no way that we should be even having a discussion about whether or not to allow LGBTQ pastors or elders. Okay? And so this is a conversation that's been going on since at least 1996 in the Cumberland Presbyterian Church. You can see where it came up at General Assembly back then. Okay? And so we've been having this conversation since at least the 90s. And it has come up several times. It's always been voted against. And then I'm not sure how it got started. I'm not sure how the conversation got started. It's been so long. But basically, the Arkansas Presbytery, the presbytery that I pastor at Cumberland Presbyterian Church in, the Arkansas Presbytery said, okay, we need to definitely hammer down on this. So we want to add an amendment that would go in the Constitution that would definitely say for sure that people who are living in a lifestyle of homosexuality, that's not the exact wording, people who are actively living in a way that is outside the bounds of the Confession of Faith's definition of marriage, which is between one man and one woman. Should not get to serve as pastor or elder. Okay. So they sent up those amendments to the presbyteries. The presbyteries voted. I'm not sure of the exact procedure, but basically the process of it is that it goes to the presbyteries for a vote. 75% of the presbyteries. Or actually, I think the first time it goes out to the presbyteries, I think it's just the majority above 50%. It doesn't have to be 75%. I could be wrong on that. But basically, I know it went out to the presbyteries the first time. The presbyteries voted to affirm that yes, that should go in the Constitution, and then it goes to General Assembly. General Assembly has to vote at that level. And once it passes at the level of General Assembly, then it has to go back to the presbyteries for a 75% majority vote, and then at that point it would go in the Constitution. If I'm wrong about that, someone who is more versed in Cumberland Presbyterian polity can correct me. But that was basically what I saw Okay. Well, I bring all of that up to say that it went through the presbyteries, it went to General Assembly, then it came back to the presbyteries, and we could not get 75% of our presbyteries to vote on that amendment, which told me, so this is how I interpreted that, okay? We could not get 75% of the presbyteries within the Cumberland Presbyterian Church to affirm an amendment that would say in black and white, plain as day, that an LGBTQ person should not serve as pastor or elder. Okay? So that told me everything I needed to know about where our denomination is headed. And the thing is, these amendments, some people, which I think this is dumb anyway, but some people voted against these amendments because they thought it was redundant. Okay? They thought it was redundant because if you're just going by like I mentioned earlier, if you're just going by the Confession of Faith and the Constitution, then there's no reason for these amendments. But the problem is, presbyteries are not enforcing the Confession of Faith and the Constitution. So this is a good example of this is a good example of this is what's going on in Mid-South Presbytery in the Cumberland Presbyterian Church. Basically, they ordained someone who is clearly living a gay lifestyle, someone who's clearly in a relationship with someone of the same sex, and they're not going to do anything about it. They said this person's going to be ordained. All right. That presbytery also voted unanimously against the amendments. Of course they did. They voted in favor of ordaining this person who is living a homosexual lifestyle. They voted in favor of ordaining this person who's living a homosexual lifestyle. And when that happened, the synod, which is the judicatory body above the presbytery, the synod, the Great Rivers Synod stepped in and said, no, we're going to suspend Mid-South Presbytery until we take this to a trial, basically. And so that's supposed to get resolved within the next 3 days, and I'll probably report on that when the results from that come out. But Mid-South Presbytery is currently under suspension. So good on Great River Synod for doing that. I'm actually very surprised by that because generally what I've seen is that most conservatives in the Cumberland Presbyterian Church just want to get along. They just want to hold hands and sing Kumbaya. So they'll let liberals be loud and proud and whatever, and they won't really do anything to stop it because everybody's got to be unified. Everybody's got to be in unity, you know. Which if you're unified around nothing, if you're unified around sin, if you're unified around chaos, then why does that matter? But that's a different conversation for a different time. Basically, 75% of the presbyteries would not affirm an amendment that clearly said in black and white that someone living outside the bounds of marriage, as it's defined in our Confession of Faith, should not serve as pastor or elder. And so I see the writing on the wall. I see the direction our denomination is headed, and I don't like it. I don't, because it's not biblical, it's not right. And here's the deal. Even if these amendments passed, I guarantee you there would still be presbyteries, probably Mid-South, that would just ignore them because they're ignoring the Confession of Faith. They're ignoring the Constitution. They don't care. They don't care about what the Bible says. They don't care about what the Confession of Faith says. They're just going to do what they want. There is nothing. So, because every pastor and elder in Mid-South that voted unanimously against the amendments, that tells me everything that I need to know about them. And what I know about them is that there is nothing to differentiate them from, there is nothing to differentiate them theologically from the PCUSA, from the Episcopal Church, from the United Methodist Church at this point, okay? From the Christian Church, Disciples of Christ, right? There is nothing theologically that differentiates them. They're all the same. They're all the same. When was the last time? So like let's so let's like let's take the real liberal Baptists. Like I know there's cooperative Baptist fellowship churches that are like super liberal and the wave rainbow and stuff. Let's take a cooperative fellowship Baptist church, for example, that's super liberal. What would differentiate someone in the cooperative Baptist fellowship from someone in the PCUSA? When was the last time you heard of a super liberal progressive PCUSA person get feisty about infant baptism against a super liberal Baptist? It's like you've never heard of that. And I think, and it's because sexuality becomes like the main thing. Once you're defined by free love or once you're defined by homosexuality, once you define yourself in that way, nothing else matters at that point. That's why you don't have these liberal movements. Let me go back to that list. So the United Church of Christ, the Episcopal Church, right? You never hear of those people having doctrinal disagreements with each other. You just don't. Because once they start defining themselves by their sexuality, they don't value anything else. Even though if you look at their doctrine on paper, it's different. Like the Episcopal Church, they still claim to go by the 39 articles. If you were to put the 39 article in like the PCUSA still claims to go by Westminster, even though they've altered it to where it doesn't even resemble what the original Westminster looked like. Even if you put like the modern PCUSA version of Westminster on paper against the 39 articles, which is what the Episcopal Church goes by, they're different. They're similar in some areas, but they're different. Okay, and you never see them talk about their differences because theological differences don't matter. Once people start to find that's, everything else goes out the window. And so, let me go back to this article. Okay. Many have wondered why traditionalists exited United Methodism when they had 5 decades. When they had across 5 decades won all the major sexuality votes from 1972 through 2019. Like I said, it's because they see the writing on the wall. Before the exits, most delegates elected to the 2020 General Conference, which was postponed repeatedly. Yeah, so they just kept kicking that can down the road. By the way, when I remember when we were talking about the issue of whether or not we were going to send amendments in Arkansas Presbytery. When we were talking about the issue of whether or not we were going to send the amendments from Arkansas Presbytery, that would basically bar anyone living outside the definition of marriage according to the Confession of Faith, from serving as pastor or elder, I remember that issue just kept getting tossed down the road, right? Anytime there was a sign of debate, anytime there was a sign of disagreement, somebody would make a motion to kick that can down the road, and somebody would second it, and it would get voted on by majority every time. God forbid there be conflict. God forbid there be conflict over something that matters. Right? And so finally, that can stopped getting kicked down the road. But you go to a Presbytery meeting, especially in Arkansas, you'll see it, man. Anytime there's a sign of disagreement over something that does in fact matter, like they'll just kick that can down the road because everybody's got to hold hands and sing Kumbaya. So, before the exits, most delegates elected to the 2020 General Conference, which was postponed repeatedly until 2024, were traditionalists. But traditionalist churches were in a bind. Yeah, they were. The deadline for a temporary policy allowing church exits with property approved in 2019, concluded in 2023, waiting for what happened in 2024 was risky. And even if traditionalists had won another win on sexuality at this year's general conference, it made slight difference. Only the African votes made this win possible. Traditionalists were losing ground in the U.S., no longer able to elect traditionalist bishops anywhere in the country. The national and local bureaucracies were hostile to traditionalists. After 59 years of continuous membership loss, United Methodism is slow. You know, it's not often I come across a word that I don't know or can't pronounce. It's really not that often. United Methodism is, well, that word, and bureaucratic. That one I know. I've had to go through enough bureaucracy in the Cumberland Presbyterian Church. I know exactly what that word is. United Methodism is that word, and bureaucratic, unable to reverse its 6 decades of decline. The old bones could not rise again. Traditionalists hope that this general conference at most might create a new path for churches to exit. After this general conference liberalizes, more churches will want to exit. That's true. Many local churches were urged to await this general conference, ignoring that their path to exit would likely conclude in 2023. This general conference is unlikely to offer another exit path, but we can pray. Well, as of right now, General Conference isn't over, so let's hope that there is another path for exit. I haven't heard anything about what went on today. I just watched a little bit of Plainspoken's live stream earlier, but I didn't have time to gather a significant amount of information. The African delegates will be disappointed by this year's general conference, but they are hopefully prepared for defeat. They are also far fewer in number than they should be because of unusual visa problems, which were worse than usual this year. In 2019, 31 African delegate seats were empty because of visa failure. This year, 70 seats, or 75% of African seats, apparently are empty thanks to visas. Many complained that United Methodist authorities were especially delinquent and unhelpful this year, even with 4 additional years to plan. Well, yeah. We renewal movements in United Methodism at every general conference since 2004 have worked up to help African delegates with their visas, sometimes asking United Methodist members of Congress to intervene, with mixed success. Then U.S. Senator Jeff Sessions personally phoned some U.S. embassies in Africa. When visas were denied to delegates, alternate delegates had no church funding to replace the block delegates. Often renewal groups paid for alternates to attend. It has always been a struggle to attain fair African representation. Even if all Africans could get visas, their representation, because of the formula, never assigned seats proportionate to their population. Although a majority of the church, they get only 1/3 of the delegates this year, with 20% of them unable to attend. I think I said 70% were not able to attend. Okay. I don't know where I read that or where I got that number, but this is juicy ecumenism is more accurate than I am, I can assure you. With 20% of them unable to attend, they are perhaps only 1/4 of the present delegates. When the U.S. delegates vote to liberalize church teachings, the African delegates, if prepared, will be anguished. It's unclear to what extent. You know, I just read that statement, and I was kind of watching the live stream yesterday over on Plainspoken, and there was one of those guys. I don't remember which one it was. There was one of those African guys that was allowed to talk. Actually, no, he wasn't there in person. They showed a video of him. And he was giving a good talk. And then about halfway through, it's like he changed gears. And all of a sudden, you realize which side he was on. So there's a few liberal African dudes. But I don't think they're the majority. It's unclear to what extent they remain in United Methodism. U.S. institutionalists are pushing regionalization, allowing Africa to set their own rules on sexuality, but many, and likely most Africans, will not find that plan tolerable. They have, by large majorities, rejected this proposal in the past. Within 5 years, I expect 80 to 90% of Africans will have exited United Methodism, leaving the denomination almost entirely U.S., only with small numbers in Europe and the Philippines. I wonder if United Methodists have a presence in Canada. I've not heard of any United Methodists in Canada, but I just wonder if there are. And I'm sure if there were, they'd be pretty liberal, because like every denomination in Canada is liberal. I heard somebody this week say that the Alliance Church in Canada has gone liberal. And that's disappointing. To what extent does this United Methodist story matter to U.S. Christianity and the wider culture? Well, not very much, as it is the culmination of a multi-decade trajectory for mainline Protestant denominations that began theologically over 100 years ago, accompanied by sharp membership losses since the 1960s. Mainline Protestantism and United Methodism are no longer important institutionally in America. For that matter, these institutions are increasingly unimportant to even members of these denominations. Church members under the age of 60 typically are indifferent to denominations and attend only because of commitment to the local church. Most will not be interested in what this general conference does, but the liberalizing impact of this general conference will, with time, affect nearly all local churches. The clergy pool will grow even more liberal as traditionalist clergy leave or retire, and traditionalist young people pursuing ministry will look elsewhere. I expect that United Methodism will functionally not exist in 10 years, although church agencies with large endowments will independently survive. Its 4 million current members will shrink by hundreds of thousands annually, and remaining members will not be interested in paying for national church bureaucracy, submitting to distant bishops, or tolerating their church property's ownership by a denomination. For that matter, other denominations will functionally not exist either. The Southern Baptist Convention, also affected by denominational indifference, may not be with us in 10 years. I think that's a stretch, because the Southern Baptist Church looks to be pretty strong. And I think it's because honestly, a third of Southern Baptist churches, like, are not really honest with who they are. So you'll see these mega churches, right? You'll see these hip mega churches that have contemporary music and the pastor's wearing skinny jeans and preaching from a New Living Translation or The Message or whatever. Or maybe even the ESV if they're halfway decent. And you'll hear a pretty generic message. You'll hear generic worship music. And I think, okay, that was a generic service. Cool, uplifting, whatever. And the name of the church is, you know, Radiant Church, or, I don't know, Praise Church, or, you know, some singular word church. And there's nothing in the service, there's nothing about the worship service, there's nothing about the preaching, there's nothing about the Sunday school class you may attend, that gives any kind of indication that it's a Southern Baptist church, okay? And I would say, like, probably a third of Southern Baptist churches are like that. Maybe that's a stretch, but I know a lot of Southern Baptist churches are like that. They're just not honest about who they are. If you ask the pastor, or if you ask the deacons, or if you ask somebody at that church, like, hey, is this a denominational church? Like, they'll tell you, yeah, we're Southern Baptist. But, like, if you walk in, like, you will not see pamphlet copies of the Baptist Faith and Message. They don't mention anything about Lottie Moon offering. Anything, nothing like that, right? And so, like, they're a Southern Baptist church that doesn't advertise they're a Southern Baptist church. And I think that's why the Southern Baptist Church... I think that's why the Southern Baptist Convention has as many members as it has. Because if these churches, especially larger ones, if these larger churches were upfront and honest and with the people who visit there, or the people who show up on Sunday morning, and they say, hey, we're a Southern Baptist church and we're going to do these Southern Baptist things, they would probably lose some people. Because a lot of people who go to those churches are not interested in denominationalism. Now, you can say that's good, you can say that's bad, or you can say that's indifferent, but that's just what it is, right? So, I think the Southern Baptist Convention will be okay as long as the as long as their churches keep hiding who they are. maybe that's gonna offend some of you SBC guys. I hope not. But Methodism and Wesleyanism as a belief system and movement, of course, will endure in different formats, bringing new vitality. I'm grateful to have been raised and spent my life in United Methodism, to which I owe so much. I first held office in my United Methodist Church in 1985 at age 20, representing my congregation at the Virginia Annual Conference. In 1988, I compiled a report for my congregation about the United Methodist Missions Agency, exchanging radical politics for evangelism, which led to my career in church activism. It's an odd sensation not to attend General Conference this year, having attended and submitted legislation to every gathering since 1992. This experience, typically 10 days of night and day of labor and combat amid countless tensions and emotions, was always draining and exhilarating. There were adversaries and defeats, but also victories and many friends. It's been a wonderful journey. When this United Methodist General Conference liberalizes, there will be media attention followed by indifference as the denomination recedes. There is a time to plant and a time to pluck up what's planted. United Methodism and its predecessor denominations play their providential role. I will miss the idea of a great national denomination as American Christianity becomes post-denominational. But to new, less centralized expressions of Christianity in America will continue and even amplify God's work. Okay, so that's the conclusion of that article. I don't have time to get into the PCUSA article that I posted. Well, I didn't post it, but I don't have time to get into the PCUSA article that I was going to show you. I've been on here for about almost an hour, and I've got to go get my wife from work soon. But I'll say this. As I said it before, and I'll say it again. The Cumberland Presbyterian Church is 5 to 10 years behind the United Methodist Church. We are charging fast in that direction. And as someone who is no longer a candidate for ministry, as someone who is no longer a candidate for ministry in the Arkansas Presbytery or any other presbytery in the Cumberland Presbyterian Church, I can't do anything about it. But for my friends who are still left, who are going to stick it out, you can do something about it. Okay? You can fight. Fighting's not easy. Fighting's ideally not what you want to do. But if you want to retain the heritage, if you want to retain the validity of the confession of faith, you must fight. I have had two different people who were pastors from different denominations ask me when I first met them, "Where do you pastor?" I tell them I'm the pastor at Mars Hill Cumberland Presbyterian Church. And they both, again, these two men do not know each other, they only know me. And they had the same reaction when I told them I pastored in the Cumberland Presbyterian Church. Man, at one time that was a biblically solid denomination, but y'all have gone downhill. One of those pastors, when it was in the Assemblies of God, and the other one is a Missionary Baptist pastor. And they both said the same thing. At one time, y'all had it together, but y'all have really gone downhill. And unfortunately, I had to agree with him. At one time, you could trust a Cumberland Presbyterian Church to be a Bible-believing, Bible-preaching church. But now, if you're looking for a Cumberland Presbyterian Church to go worship at, you need to check out their website. You need to listen to their sermons. And you need to listen closely. And if their pastor's on social media, you need to look at what their pastor's posting on social media. Because you could walk into a Cumberland Presbyterian church and find yourself sitting in a pew where the pastor is telling you that the Bible is nothing more than the glorified fairy tale, and that we would be better off if we didn't have all of these intolerant ideals and just a bunch of junk. Political correctness, identity politics, defining yourself by your sexuality, all the stuff. Now, I can assure you that if you want to come to Mars Hill Cumberland Presbyterian Church, as long as I'm the pastor there, you'll hear a Bible-based sermon. You will experience liturgical worship, complete with a call to worship, responsive reading, confession of sin, and assurance of pardon. And if you show up on the right Sunday, you might even get the Lord's Supper. But, you know, unfortunately, you can't say that anymore about every Cumberland Presbyterian Church. And that makes me sad. And that hurts me. That hurts me as someone who loves the Cumberland Presbyterian Church. Thanks for joining me on this episode of Acceptable Words. And I'll see you guys later. Hopefully this will be a regular thing for me now that I've got some equipment. So I will talk to you guys later.